How's it going, everybody? This is Mark Ciaffardini with Go See Talk. Happy Friday to you. Hope the sun is shining and the birds are chirping. We are excited to speak to the head honchos of White Bear PR, Chandler Poling and Thomas McHughes. We are going to speak to them about everything they do to bring composers to journalists and help get the music out in the world from the PR side. And we have a million and a half questions. So we're going to roll right into it. Guys, thank you so much for being part of this podcast.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Let's go back to the very beginning. What got you into music?
Well, I'll go first. This is Chandler. And I got into music because my father is a musician. Actually, my whole family is very musical, but my father is a professional musician. He is a songwriter, composer. He also is in all sorts of bands. So growing up, he was in like an 80s new wave band playing keys and singing. But he also was writing commercial jingles, and we have a baby grand piano in our house. And so I got into music just through being, you know, growing up with my family and singing, you know, Christmas carols on the piano. And my mom is a great singer as well. She can play guitar. And then my sisters, who are younger than me, also were great singers. So, which is a little tiny Von Trapp family situation where we're all very musical. And yeah, that's how I got into music to begin with. And then later would learn to study saxophone. And I taught myself how to play piano, and eventually decided that being a musician was not my calling because I was not great at it. So I thought I'll just leave the instruments to people who are very good at playing them.
Excellent. Well, I heard a rumor that in order to play saxophone, you either have to do it shirtless or with some gold chains. What was your take on the matter?
I had like a curly mullet thing going on, you know. that was my qualification.
Excellent. Excellent. And Thomas, I heard you ventured across the seas to be here to join us. Please tell us about your upbringing.
Yeah, no, I'm from Vienna in Austria, the city of music, Mozart, Strauss. And it's funny because I was just thinking, I had this weird music taste when I grew up, you know, from, I think one of my first cassette tapes, and I must've been 7 or 8, I saved money and I got waltzes by Strauss. And I actually still have that tape. And then I got it on vinyl also. So that was like my early music taste. And I think it had to do with my grandmother, because I was with her from like Sunday through Thursday. And that's what she would listen to on radio. And then obviously in my, you know, then once I got it, became a teenager, I got more into Euro disco. And then my first concert I went to, I was 14, and it was a big deal to, so the, you know, my parents let me go till midnight. And that was Kaja Gugu with, you know, had Too Shy Shy. And I think Limahl was still part of the band back then. It was before Never Ending Story. Yeah, so that was kind of my music upbringing. I don't have any music. I'm not very musically. I don't, you know, I can tell you I like it or I don't like it. And I still have a weird music taste, which I think Chandler can attest to, from Bollywood music to Falco, Euro music and classic. Yeah, and my first, I was also thinking, what were my first soundtrack vinyls I got? And I think, I don't know which one was first, but my first two I purchased were Green Card and Driving Miss Daisy. So those, I still have those vinyl. I brought them to Los Angeles. So, yeah. And then, you know, I had so many different jobs. I was a flight attendant for Lufthansa from my early 20s to, I didn't have any money. I you know, I was an apprentice in a bookstore. I started working when I was 14 also. And so I'm like, the only way to get out of Austria is to be a flight attendant with no money. So they took me and I got to see the world, traveled all over Asia and ended up in America eventually.
Wow, that is a story in and of itself. It's funny you say the only way to leave Austria is on a plane.
Well, you could take the train, go to Italy.
Well, Chandler, going back, I was actually very impressed that you taught yourself to play piano. How did that happen?
Well, I learned how to read music because of my saxophone lessons. Okay. So I was in the high school band, marching band, pep band at you know, football games. And because we had a piano at home, I just bought piano sheet music and just figured it out. You know, I never was like really proficient at it, but you know, I could play things. And I remember my father, who is not good at reading music, would always be so amused that I would have, you know, these books of, you know, Beethoven or whatever, and I'd be playing it, and he's just like, "You're just reading the notes and playing it?" I was like, "Yes." He's like, "That's amazing," because he's an ear musician. He can hear for Elise by Beethoven and then figure it out exactly, but looking at sheet music is not his forte.
Mm-hmm. I think the last time I looked at sheet music was probably the fifth grade when we were in music class, the different bars and rests, and to me it's as nebulous as algebra. And so I'm so glad I like writing, and I actually do Go See Talk as a hobby. I'm actually in architecture and interior design, so things like that just amaze me. And I love the process of creating something with, I don't want to say it's arcane, because music is something that's shared universally, but it's just it takes a very particular set of skills, to quote a certain Irishman, to pull it off correctly. So that's interesting. And Thomas, to go back to what you said about the Driving Miss Daisy, you know, vinyl is really having its day in the sun. That's a pretty sought after album in Zimmer's catalog. You probably fetch a good buck on Discogs if you ever want to give it up.
No, I'm not going to give it up. I'm glad when I, you know, I had like this amazing book collection. You know, that was my first job to work in a bookstore from 14 to 19. So I had like a lot of first editions and great collections. And, you know, when you move to America, then you know, I had to give up a lot of things. And my book collection was part of that. I actually sold a lot to make money. Mm-hmm. But my vinyls, for some reason, I didn't want to give up. So I kept them. They stayed in Austria. And eventually, you know, on several trips, I got those metal boxes and I brought them here. So I'm very happy to have them. And not only those, my collection, I also inherited my dad's 45 collection. So I have a lot of first editions of Elvis Presley and Beatles and everything. They're all without a cover, unfortunately. They're just, you know, the 45s in a plastic folder. But I'm really holding on to all of that.
That's great. Do you spin them regularly, or do they kind of just take up space in your apartment or house?
No. I listen to vinyls, and even with Spotify, I rather listen to the vinyls. There's a few vinyls I already know I have to go to the vinyl player and push it because there's a scratch on it and make sure it. No, and there's some stuff I have, you know, especially with Bollywood music and the film soundtracks, like that I don't think exists on Spotify, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's nice to have that sort of go-to and scarcity. I think there's a lot of music out there. And it's funny, you mentioned Bollywood. I was in college in 98 to 2002, and I'll never forget, there was I'm going to butcher his name, but I think that the artist's name is Dyler Mendick, and the song is called Duruk Duruk, and it's a whole thing about the elements. He plays mm-hmm. multiple characters, and they do, it's kind of like the fifth element. And so if it wasn't for college and things that you probably can't get anywhere else, I think things like that expanded your music, my musical palette. So maybe on that note, what transformative experience got you, kind of like opened your world and said, wow, this is how deep this cave goes? You know, I like, I don't know, harpsichord music or something.
Well, first of all, I definitely know the Duruk Duruk song. I remember it very distinctly. I don't remember the artist's name, but uh-huh. It's just funny that you brought it up, because I remember distinctly my friends and I sharing this kind of music video around.
I'm going to turn it on now. I think I'm going to listen to it again after this.
What opened up me to music, like, or soundtrack specifically?
No, just what do you think really expanded your palate? I guess maybe my dad, I grew up on The Doors, Sinatra, and Johnny and Edgar Winter. And I just, there was some sort of, they were all felt like they were going in similar, but maybe different directions. And I think it was just interesting to see what type of music was out there. So was there maybe something that you heard and it took you down a different path from, you know, what your friends were listening to? Just
Sure. Yeah. So I remember distinctly my musical world being opened up by, I used to work at a Subway when I was a teenager, and I had a coworker named Liz, and she introduced me to Portishead, and that introduced me to just a whole different kind of subgenre of music, which they call trip hop. Mm-hmm. And I was like really obsessed with Portishead and still am today. And, Beth Gibbons, if you're listening, please give us a call. We'd love to work with you. And then anyways, we just, you know, loved all of that. And that kind of really opened up a whole different musical world for me, was through Portishead.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, for me, I think a big influence on music for me is my love for travel. And, you know, like I talked about being a flight attendant to see the world, but then, you know, I also always took big chunks of time off from work to travel to India for a few months, or to go to Thailand, to go to Greece for long periods of times. And then, you know, obviously I also got to love the music, you know, world music from those countries. And so I'm sure this had a huge influence. And then just the time, you know, I was also lucky, you know, when we're working in a bookstore, we also had a big record store. And, you know, all the, you know, back then, all the classical singers from, you know, Austria and from the opera house, you know, would come by and do signings, you know, from Domingo de Carreras to Agnes Balzer, you know, all those people. And so I have tons of signed vinyls also that I brought with me that, you know, I just didn't, back then, you know, I was 16, 17, I didn't think anything. I'm like, oh, there's someone famous, let them sign it. And yeah, and then... you know, all the world music influence and yeah, and then, you know, like, you know music, I was big on Broadway also growing up in Austria. You know, it's, you know, that was the time musicals came to Austria. That was not until the 80s. And so I was big on that. And then, you know, also music films like Flashdance, Footloose, Dirty Dancing, that I think all had a huge impact on me, you know, for music, but also for opening up my want to move to the United States and move to Los Angeles eventually. You know, I really think filmmaking, film storytelling combined with music made me want to move to the States, you know, that it kind of evoked that feeling in me.
Okay. Well, Chandler, I imagine that, I think this can go either way. Sometimes when there's a profession in the family, sometimes it's encouraged, sometimes it's discouraged. What kind of conversations did your parents or in your family have with you to help kind of push you closer to being in LA and around musicians and...
Sure. Yeah. First of all, I need to redact a little bit or retract. Obviously, when I talked about Portishead, I need to shout out, of course, to Jeff Barrows, who is from Portishead and is a film composer, does amazing work, Ex Machina, whatever. Anyways, just to say. Anyways, yeah, my parents were definitely not forceful in any sort of career decision. They were very open-minded as far as whatever I wanted to do. They were there to support. I was originally a chemistry major in college, and then I switched to a theater major halfway through and ended up minoring in Asian art history. So I kind of was like a bit all over the map. And of course, my plan was to move to New York and work in Broadway and theater. And I got this opportunity to move to LA and stay with a friend of my father's. And so it was just more of a push out the door than anything, but my dad just essentially was like, you should just go there, try it out, see what LA is like. And if you don't like it, you can then go to New York. And so I got into the production scene here, not music, but actual on-set production work when I first moved here through the connections of my father's friend. And I never left. So I just stayed in LA ever since that moment.
Well, why don't we jump into White Bear as an entity? Can we talk about the origins of it? You guys have treated journalists like myself so well. I want to give you this platform to tell everything about, you know, what being a publicist is. And you guys work tirelessly. So let's do Publicist 101. Let's tell us about White Bear's origins.
Okay, sure. So yeah, White Bear PR's origin, we launched in 2011. Thomas and I were previously working at a different PR firm and made the decision to launch this company with a focus on film music overall. So while the previous firm had multiple different disciplines that they represented, we were really connecting with film music and composers. So we launched the company focused on composers, songwriters, record labels, and all that sort of stuff. And now we are 10 years later.
Yeah, and I think we both kind of fell into it accidentally, really, you know, because I mean, as Chandler said, he was in production, worked on the television series Heroes. I was a talent agent before. I booked all the headline acts on cruise ships worldwide for a few years and ran the Los Angeles branch of that Miami-based company. And I had left because I felt I just didn't feel the connection to cruise ships. It's just not my form of travel and entertainment. And so I left and I was looking for a job, and Chandler left, I think, third season of Heroes, right? And so a friend of us said, hey, you know, I'm working with these two composers. He was employed at DreamWorks back then, so he didn't really have the time to spend on them. So he asked us if we could help him, me doing all the behind the scenes and financial stuff for the company, Chandler doing publicist work, and that was two composers, Jim Dooley and Nathan Barr. Those were, I think, the first two people we worked with, and so we worked for a year and a half for that company. And for me, it was totally new. Although, you know, I come from tourism, and then I was an agent, and I always to do with travel. I didn't know what a publicist is. I didn't even know it exists. I was always good with people, creative, but I did not know what a PR firm is. So that kind of, it was total accident. And then I just really enjoyed it. Working in music, I thought composers are the best people to work with, you know, in the entertainment industry. I really fell into it.
I've been doing this a little over 10 years. I crossed paths with, you know, your contemporaries, Chasen PR, Krakauer Group, other outfits like that. But can you clarify, a publicist is not an agent?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, not an agent. A publicist, so we promote and we publicize our clients to the media, and an agent does their promotions to like a hiring entity, like a studio or network. Okay. So we're kind of representing an individual, but we're pitching or, you know, representing towards different industries or different entities.
Okay.
I do have to say, though, because, where other screenwriters or actors, directors, there's agents, there's managers. And really, in our world, there's only a handful of agents and there's hardly any managers. So I think what happens to us in the PR world and what I've seen over the last few years, where, you know, traditionally we would just get, you know, we would run award campaigns, or if a composer has a film at a festival, we would represent them there, make sure they are taken care of on the red carpet, they're interviewed. When films are reviewed, they also listen to the music and write about the music and the impact of the music on the storytelling. And then we get editorial pieces on composers. We do award campaigns, and, you know, it's beside media also a lot of logistics and, you know, voter reach out, etc. And connecting them also within the industry. But now more and more I feel, because there is no managers and agents are very busy, you know, they are getting work, they cut deals, but then we come in often and also maybe introduce them to music supervisors or help them with getting a soundtrack release or connecting them with music departments or helping them with concert events, etc. So I feel that the lines get a bit blurred at the moment because there is just this void that there's no manager for composers out there, which I always think if someone wants to do that, there is a niche.
and composing in and of itself, or at least being publicist for composers, is itself a niche market. I remember having discussions with some journalists who worked for big outlets like film.com and the New York Times. They were saying, they suggested, well, if you love music so much, you should try covering music, because everyone and their mother posts a trailer or those god-awful trailer reactions. Don't get me started. But the idea of that, you know, composers, they need, I think they need more of an audience. And I'm so glad that they've been, thanks to all the tireless work you guys do, they are getting more of an audience. All that said, maybe let's just go back. Are there things that you, what are some of the movies and soundtracks that you love that maybe just fuel your passion for representing these brilliant musicians? Maybe you have top three scores that you listen to on repeat.
Wow. Okay. Top three.
I'll go 30. It looks like I cornered you. Sorry.
No, it's just, it's a funny question because one, we get introduced to so many soundtracks at once at all times for the past 10 plus years. So I've never thought about like the top. I can definitely speak to some of my favorites. And I always start with the first soundtrack I ever purchased, score soundtrack, which is Monsoon Wedding by Michael Dana. And I love that score. What?
You took mine. I'm like, oh, but he's taking my Indian music away.
No, yeah, that was the very first score soundtrack I ever purchased. So I think that's incredible. I obviously love Star Wars by John Williams. I think it's some of the best, you know, music, E.T. and all that sort of stuff. But I'm trying to think of like, I love the Stranger Things soundtrack by Kyle Dixon and Michael Stein. It's always like my most listened to Spotify streams. Every time I get the year end report, it's always like Kyle Dixon and Michael Stein are your top artists. I'm like, geez, I have to listen to more music because I listen to their scores so much. Yeah, I mean, there's a handful of scores that I love.
Okay. So Thomas Chandler took the wind out of your sails, but
he took hit him Michael back. Dana. my favorite soundtrack is probably The Mission, which I know a lot of people love, and you know, I think it's just, you know, it's for me, you know, I listen to it and it has an emotional impact. And the other soundtrack that does the same thing is Lion by Volker Bertelmann and Dustin O'Halloran. It's, you know, it's when a soundtrack, when I listen to it and it evokes the exact same emotion I had when I watched the movie, then it works for me. And those two, I listen to the music and I immediately get the images and the emotion. And those two soundtracks are like that. Currently on my, you know, on my Spotify year, and this year it was Husavik, so Eurovision Song Contest. I must have listened a lot to last year, and we are currently working on an Oscar campaign on Husavik. So The Queen's Gambit on television lately, I think it's a beautiful, Carlos Rafael Rivera is just really amazing and the kindest person you can, you'll ever meet. For the longest time, Oblivion by Joseph Trapanese, I listened to it over and over again. And I can't remember the composer at the moment, but for many years, and I still sometimes listen to The Two Lives or the Double Life of Veronique. It's a Polish composer. And is it Preissner or Chandler? Do you know? I forgot. Also wrote the trilogy Red, Blue, and White. And I'm blanking at the moment, but it's just, you know. Oh, and you know, another soundtrack I listen to a lot is Carrington, Michael Nyman.
Yeah, I also really like Patrick Doyle's Cinderella. That's
one of my favorites.
So stunning.
Yeah.
I've spoken to Patrick Doyle quite a bit. I know Cinderella very well. And I'm a big fan of Life of Pi, so I'm glad that there's some Michael Dana love out there. Great.
I think he also did Water, didn't he? And that's a beautiful soundtrack, too.
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I think one of, you know, composers, a lot of times they say that they're in a room by themselves. They spend so much time siloed. There is sort of a path to, you know, to the director, the producer, the mixing board, and then out to the world. And I feel like, not to discredit composers, they are kind of their path is one line. And I think maybe to be a publicist and a handler, you got to be good at a lot of things, you know, outreach and vision and where you want to position these people, especially with a Oscar campaign. So how, I know your team is small, but how do you share the responsibilities and how do you target what you want to achieve with these composers?
Yes. So go ahead, Thomas.
One of the things we discussed on early, and it was basically when we started with WhiteBand coming off the company that we previously worked, you know, where a lot of companies, you have a point person and that's the person you work with. And we didn't want that. We always felt like we want the creative input of the entire team. So that's what we kind of, although there's point people to specific projects, we still all kind of work on it. Meaning, you know, we have weekly meetings at least once a week where we go over everyone, where we all give creative input, where we come up with strategy. And how it usually works when we, you know, work on a new project, we always work project based, even if it's a composer that we've worked with for many years, like Benjamin Wallfisch or Joseph Trapanese. But then when they come back with a new project, we always meet and look at that specific project and see what is unique about it. What is the story that we can tell? We think it's not just enough to say, hey, I'm a composer and I did Mortal Kombat, like with Benjamin Wallfisch at the moment. We then go further and say, yeah, but what's the story? What's your emotional connection to it? Or what was the discussions with the director? Is there a unique instrumentation? Did you like Volker Bertelmann with the upcoming Stowaway? He created new instruments with wire to create that space sound. So, you know, Hilde Gunnar Dottir, that's, you know, that story has been told all over again with the bathroom dance with a Joker. So we look what is unique, what could be of interest to the media and to the general audience, obviously. How can someone benefit from learning that? You know, it's not just enough to say, hey, I'm cool and I did that. I think it needs to go a bit deeper. And that's always the first conversation we have. And usually it should be aligned also to the goal of what the composer wants to achieve with PR.
Gotcha. And I think that's helpful to the journalist too, because if you were to just say, I have X musician and they've released X album, put it out to the world. You know, I think that journalists need some guidance. So I think what you're doing is you're helping kind of streamline content so they can either piggyback on it or maybe take a different angle. So no, I love that. That's great. You know, Chandler, you had an interview with Pinar Toprak, and she, one of the things she said was, if she didn't ask for it, she never would have gotten it, which I thought was just a very simple way of advancing yourself in your professional career. Do you have maybe a similar story to where or experience?
Well, it's funny because something just happened yesterday about that. But I'm trying to think if that wasn't me asking this, that was a client asking. We're working on Mortal Kombat, which comes out. And just today we launched the Techno Syndrome remix that just came out like a couple hours ago.
I just listened to that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this visualizer music video kind of thing that they released. And they got it to us a little late to review, but you know, even though we had a day until it came out, Benjamin Wallfisch, the composer, still asked for the a revision on it. Even, you know, it's just like, you gotta ask for it, otherwise you might not get it. And of course they turned around, they did the edit, and it looks even better. And you know, you're doing that, I think, is really important, because you know, our job, we get told no way more than we get told yes. So when you're pitching journalists and when you're doing outreach and all that sort of stuff, you have to know that you have to ask. Because if you go in thinking, well, they're just going to say no, then you're not going to get anywhere, because you're already assuming that you're defeated. But, you know, like our job is to go out there and ask for it, as Pinar says. Otherwise, it's never going to happen.
Gotcha.
And I think it goes even a bit further, you know, because we do a lot of talks at universities, at, you know, NYU, USC, University of Miami, to young composers and artists about, you know, PR and who they are as an artist. And what I realize more and more, and it's even seasoned composers. So the first step for me is to actually know what you want. You know, it's not only asking it, but I think a lot of artists kind of are in this space where they just want to be an artist, but not asking themselves, who am I as an artist and what do I want? You know, it's one of the first conversations always we always have is, you know, if you hire us, what are your goals? And I'm surprised how many people actually don't have PR goals. You know, they hire us, but they don't even know what they want with it. Or they want a career, but they not. And I think the more you know, even if you don't get it right away, or even if there's a no, it really helps you go forward in life and go forward in your career, because you define yourself. You know, and a lot of composers, unfortunately, I feel, and maybe it's the industry we are in, are kind of timid to ask for it. And I think, you know, then you have to overcome that. Other, you know, no one else is going to do it for you. Mm-hmm. And you just have to be learn that a no is not the end of the world, and you still know what you want, and you keep going on.
Mm-hmm. You know, I find that composers kind of fall into two categories. They're either very humble or they're extremely charismatic. Now, I go back to Patrick Doyle because he's probably the happiest guy on the planet. But how do you?
I was just going to ask you for names now. Who are the timid ones, and who are the big egos?
I didn't say big ego. I said charismatic. It's like, okay. but how do you, as a publicist, how do you have conversations to maybe give them courage? I know it's really crazy to ask, but I mean, how do you give them maybe the confidence to help find their voice on an outreach level, not exactly at the keyboard?
Yeah, for sure. So a great example is most composers, 99% of the composers we work with are on the timid scale. They're more introverted, as you said before. They are alone a lot of the time. So what they often feel like they don't have a place within the media. And our job obviously is to give them the confidence that they do have a story to tell, and people are actually very interested in hearing it. And I'll let Thomas tell the story, but we had a client who went to a premiere and was just too afraid to walk on the red carpet. But there was media interested in asking musical questions. Do you want to tell this story, Thomas?
Yeah, I mean, it happened to me a few times where, you know, a composer, you know, hires us and we go to the premiere or the film festival and we get to the red carpet. And then a composer is like, oh, you know what? I don't want to walk the red carpet. Let's just skip the red carpet. And I'm like, well, you hired us. I'm here. There's interest. And in that particular film, there were, you know, there was a big star, the director and the composer. And a composer didn't want to walk the carpet. I'm like, okay, so let's wait a moment. And then the director arrived and she got timid too. And she didn't want to walk to the carpet. And then Hilary Swank, and then she walked the carpet. And then, and both the director and the composer felt, well, we don't want to take away from her. We don't want to, you know, she should shine. And then eventually the director walked, and I'm like, well, you have to look at it as a team. The director and the actor cannot talk about the music. Only you can talk about the music and the impact on the storytelling. And the media wants to know that there's so many fans of film music on there, and you don't do it for you, you do it for the project. You are here now as a representative of the film. You are an element of that. So even if you feel humble, then don't think that you do it for your ego or your career. Think about that you are doing it to support the film and get the word out for the film. And I think that helps a lot when you get away from, oh, I'm talking about me. And a lot of people are, terrified of that, or being seen as, you know, selfish maybe. But if you realize, no, you are doing, you're helping the project itself, you're helping the film. And I think that mindset then helps often. And it's more so with European composers than with US composers, I feel.
Okay. Do you think that has to do with the audience in different parts of the world, or the schooling they get, or?
I think it has to do with, you know, there's a different humbleness, and that, you know, it's kind of often frowned about in, you know, in continental, but also in England, you know, when you're too much in the media, when you're too much in front, you know, because you're supposed to be humble. Mm. And also, you know, we realized, I mean, we have a lot of UK-based clients, and now also Nordic composers, Icelandic, Swedish, German, but there is really no PR over there. There is no, you know, there's one PR company now in Brussels, Ghent. It's for composers, it's not very you know, they usually don't do PR. They don't do many interviews. It's not the same as here.
Okay. I will say, though, that in my experience of doing events in especially the UK is the film publicist can be quite rude to creative talent, you know, unless you're the star. They're quite rude. And one thing that I was really surprised about is a great example with Patrick Doyle. When we went to the Cinderella premiere in London, he told me before we started, because he's had plenty of experience leading up to this, he said, sharpen your elbows, because you're going to really have to elbow your way into this, because they're going to try to skirt us around and just have us not be participate. He's like, this movie means a lot to me. I would really like to support the director. Can we, let's just make sure that we do this. And so I said, okay, no problem. I don't care if I offend a publicist as I'm like trying to get the composer on. But it was really amazing to see how their training is to put down creative talent like that, because even the journalists were like, we'd like to speak to Patrick. We'd like to speak to Patrick. And the publicist was like, no, you can't. And I just, you know, elbowed my way past them and just brought Patrick right to the journalist, because that's what they want. They want to speak to him. That's what they're there for. And so it's just really interesting when Thomas says European composers, they have that experience, or they might have that mindset or that idea that they're not good enough for this kind of publicity, because there is a pecking order, or so to speak, where it's just not it's not as supportive to all the creative industries that they have there.
Okay.
Yeah, it's funny. I have the same experience. I was just thinking back when I did the tour with Joe Kramer when he did Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, and the world premiere was at the State Opera House in Vienna. It was amazing. They closed on the Opera House. They closed on the street in front of it for 2 days, built this gigantic red carpet stage that went up to the balcony and down and then into the audience. And then Tom Cruise was like for an hour entertaining the thousands of people. And so we did that, and that kind of, the PR team wasn't also, you know, no, he's not an actor. And I'm like, yeah, but it worked because I was from Austria. So we got on the carpet, we did tons of interviews. Then 2 days later, we did London, and the same thing. I kind of had to force my way on the red carpet because British publicists, no one wants to talk to a composer. And by then, you know, we've traveled with, Tom Cruise and he's like, no, come over here, let's take a photo together. So it was already, and then we did New York Times Square, which they closed off, and no problem at all. US, you know, the film publicist, no, everyone, and you know, take a photo with JJ and with Tom and Alec Baldwin and everyone. So, you know, there is a difference, and especially in the UK, I feel that the film PR team and the studio PR, they haven't realized yet what an asset a composer is, and really everyone on the film is, you know, all the below the line people. But, you know, there's, especially in Europe, there's such a market for film music, so many fans. I mean, it's like, you know, Hilda Gunnadottir is a rock star over there, you know, also here. But you know, if you go to concerts there, if you go to Krakow, if you go to Ghent, you know, film music is celebrated, but there's a disconnect between the film PR people and mm-hmm. and that world.
And you mentioned Ghent, that's where they have the World Soundtrack Awards, don't they?
Correct. Yeah,
and that's a pretty big draw, and that's something that's also growing. And I remember one of the discussions I had with Paul Leonard Morgan. I said, what is it about me? Because he was finishing up Cyberpunk 2077. I said, what is it about video game music that gets people so, I mean, is it the style of music? Is it how it hits you in the heart? And he goes, it's because you play the game like 15 hours. Like, you know, you watch a movie, 90 minutes, you're done. TV show, maybe 10 episodes. But I never put that together, because my video game experience is playing the 5 levels of DuckTales on the NES. I'm like, okay, I could sing those notes backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
But the idea of, you know, when I talked to Brian Tyler, I said, like, how difficult is it to write music for film or video games? He goes, video games are way tougher because you write the eventualities that a player will encounter, and you have to sort of like all these undiscovered locations. It's not as linear. So mm-hmm. all that said, yeah, I can see why video game music is just so... It's on another level, literally, but it grabs people in a different, similar but much different way.
Yeah, well, and you said 15 hours, that's on the low end. I mean, most games are 40 minimum up to 100 hours. So mm-hmm. yeah, you live in that audio world much longer than you do in a film.
Well, let me ask you a question about how your outreach to journalists, what kind of barrier to entry is there now that everybody's got an outlet, everybody's got a blog? How do you prioritize? How do you work with these journalists? You know, like, I don't have near the numbers for the Hollywood Reporter, but I still value the time that you spend with me and the opportunities that you throw my way. So how do you work with big outlets, small outlets, and then people just wanting to get into the mix who have never done this before?
Yeah, absolutely. So the dealing or pitching journalists, it evolves constantly, you know, because it stems a lot from relationships. So just because you have a journalist friend that would run a blog like yourself, there you have no idea, but I've had so many smaller blog journalists get hired into Variety, get hired onto major platforms. And because we have that prior relationship and we supported their smaller press venue, they were very open to pitches and very willing to work with us to work in stories, or very communicative in saying, this is not the right fit for us, but you want to talk to this person at the company now, and connecting us in all that sort of way. So I really feel there's value in both. There's value in larger scale publications, and there's a lot of value in smaller scale publications, because audiences that read New York Times are not the same audiences that read a nerdy blog, you know? So it's just, you have to kind of think of it as a wide approach. You want to reach as many people positively as you can, and you have to embrace all spectrums of the kind of media.
Okay.
Well, and also, you know, composers really enjoy talking to blogs often, because there is just a more genuine interest in film music, you know, where, you know, a Hollywood Reporter, or Variety, or, you know, some outlets, it depends on the journalist, of course, but some of the questions might be very general, and where some bloggers might, you know, dig in a bit deeper or have more an understanding of music. And then, you know, it also depends on the project. There's some projects where, you know, it depends on the release date, it depends on the distribution, and, you know, there's so many factors, and we kind of can tell early on. And we also, I mean, one of the things we said from the get-go is that we don't want to overpromise to clients, that we want to be very honest in evaluating what we can do. And sometimes it's better to pause or to not do a project and wait for the right project. You know, Hildur, I've known 4 years before we started working on Chernobyl, and they have plenty of projects, but it was never the right time. And so, you know, it's important, and we don't want clients to spend money when we think we cannot deliver. And then when it comes to outlets, we're also good in evaluating and feeling, well, this is a project that might be better for, you know, we probably can get several blog interviews, but we won't get a big outlet. And, but then when it comes to also us, you know, our integrity with journalists, we cannot only pitch smaller projects to bloggers, you know, otherwise, you know, I feel also we want to give everything to bloggers, because if we need a blogger, then for a smaller project, we also need to give them the, you know, it needs to be both. Otherwise we would use people, and, you know, we obviously don't want that.
Yeah. Well, I can't tell you guys and everyone else who I've worked with in the past 12 years, how grateful I was. I mean, the first composer interview I ever had, was with James Newton Howard. Now, talk about a holy grail. I haven't been able to get time with him since. I kind of worked an angle with the Dallas Symphony, but I mean, the opportunity to speak to Sergio Mendes and Brian Tyler and Steve Jablonski, and just the list goes on and on. And I feel incredibly fortunate, but I sometimes feel that if you keep showing up and do good work, that's going to be the return on the process. And so that's another story. One of the things I'm most curious about, not being an agent, I imagine that if you're an agent and you get a musician a gig, or they got a project, that's a win. How do you celebrate a win, and what have been some big wins for publicists?
Well, obviously awards are a big win for us. We're very influential and a big part of the award campaigning process. So, I mean, those are few and far between in the sense of winning an actual statue, but a nomination is a great win, obviously, for us. But on a weekly basis, you know, getting great media coverage feels great all the time. You know, getting Variety articles or Rolling Stone articles or wherever we're doing our outreach, getting any sort of coverage like that for our client and getting the positive feedback that comes from that is always super rewarding.
Excellent.
And I think, you know, it's not always, you know, even when you run an award campaign as a composer, it's not always necessarily, you know, being nominated or winning. Sometimes the award campaign can also lead to more work. You know, we've worked with composers and it's kind of out of our hand. It's the show, it's the timing again. But, you know, we've run campaigns with composers who didn't get a nomination, but then they had 5 TV shows. And I do think that the media coverage and, you know, being talked about and people listening to the music has to do with that. And I think personally also, I think both of us, I can probably speak for Chandler, one of the founding members of the Alliance for Women Film Composers, and I'm now on the board for the second time. And I think that is also, you know, seeing more and more women composers in the industry and working, you know, that for me is a success, you know, as a personal success also, because I feel we really supported very hard and worked hard on that. And with our community, with women composers, you know, things like that for me are very, you know, make me very happy. Or, you know, just, you know, when composers call and say how, you know, how lucky they are, how happy they feel to work with us. And it feels like family, you know. But obviously awards from Emmys to Oscars and all that is something to celebrate.
Okay. Well, speaking of award season and, you know, things that are, you mentioned Benjamin Wallfisch a couple times. What are some of the big campaigns that you had this year? I feel like I missed out on a good chunk of it, but please, maybe this is your time to put a spotlight on things that you're passionate about.
Well, as Thomas mentioned, Husavik, the song from Eurovision Song Contest story of Fire Saga.
Wait, what was it?
Ding Dong.
Yeah, oh,
that's not up for anything?
No, it's
but Husavik is, and it's a beautiful song. It's very touching, and again, you know, it's one of those things where it really had an effect on the storytelling. The climax of the show was supposed to be a comedic ending, and the way it was written was that the song was supposed to be this big orgasmic climax, and with a comedy song, and then they also wrote this heartfelt song about hometown, and you know, they changed the script and made, you know, you can see how music can also have an impact on storytelling, and that's beautiful to see. And it's the only song this year that is part of the storytelling and not end credits, so it's nice to work on that.
We're working on all sorts of cool stuff. Obviously, Mortal Kombat, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier is really awesome. Lovecraft Country for an Emmy campaign. I mean, that was such a remarkable show, and The Queen's Gambit. I feel like Shadow and Bone is going to be super cool. That comes out at the end of the month. That's a Netflix series by Joseph Trapanese. So much.
We're working on Black Widow might come out eventually.
Black Widow, yeah, later this year. And of course, and I might be really excited about is a song from RuPaul's Drag Race. So we're a big fan of that show, and so we're working with the songwriters from that reality competition show. So we love it.
Okay, great. And Lauren Balfe is doing the Black Widow. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And then Stranger Things might come out the end of this year. Have there been any
November work? I think they moved it to, right?
Yeah,
was the latest.
You know, until they make the official announcement, I feel like everything is nebulous.
Okay.
But I look forward to it because season 3 was awesome.
Yeah, it really was.
And I look forward to shows this month. Stowaway, the film, you know, Volker Bertelmann did the score. He just did Your Honor. And Jupiter's Legacy, I'm looking forward to also next month. Stephanie
Economo
always worked a lot with Harry Gregson Williams, and it's a great score. So I look forward to that series also.
Excellent. You know, one of the things I'm most curious about is how you know, every industry was affected by COVID. If you can chime in on lessons learned or, you know, wins and losses, how did you personally and as a company fare last year? And maybe how have you parlayed that into a successful trajectory this year?
Well, I feel good. I mean, as far as I felt like we were able to keep busy and keep successful. The biggest change, in my opinion, was the loss of live events. So concerts, red carpets, networking events, screenings, Q&As, like all that sort of stuff went away and became very digital. Thomas, sorry, what were you going to say?
No, that we, you know, early on last year, you know, but I remember we had conversations in April, May, and of course we were worried, you know, production stopped. So we thought there's no projects to promote. And, you know, we love our employees. They've been with us for years. And I think that's the greatest asset we have because, you know, it's all about personal relationships. So that was one of the earliest discussion we had that, you know, we have to make sure that we can keep the employees and not have to furlough or anything. And that was my biggest worry. And knock on wood, it worked. We got everyone through the year. And it was surprising that really I felt like there was more work than before. I think media was hungry and they wanted content. The streaming services kept producing or bought European shows, a lot of documentaries. And then award season started and it was super long this year. And it was more work though, because I feel we had to be also more creative. We had to do a lot of content creation, like, you know, at Sundance this year, which was all virtual. And so we got this virtual house on the virtual main street online. And, you know, we produced within 3 weeks, 43 or 47 panels, workshops, keynote conversations, you know, from Rob Simonsen, Michael Dana, Miriam Cutler, you name it, Rufus Wainwright, Mary J. Blige, and it was a lot of work. So it was a lot of work. So we couldn't rely on other people creating the content because all those festivals, all those, you know, nothing happened. So we had to step in and create opportunities for our composers, mm-hmm. which we continue to do.
Well, I do feel that on the plus side, had this happened 10, 15 years ago, I think without the ability to teleconference with people, I think there would have been a deeper impact to publicity and journalism. Because one of the things that I lament is that I love the face-to-face. I love being in the room with the talent when they're visiting, you know, directors and actors. You get 5-6 minutes and then you're done. But I do love the fact that you're in an opportunity now where you can have an hour-long conversation. The barriers and the point of entry has kind of been erased and you kind of have this sort of free flowing organic conversation as opposed to a boom, 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 like with a PA tour. So I think that gives a lot of artists more opportunity to get their word out there and shine.
The reason also we do so many classes and panels and, you know, for the Society of Composers and Lyricists and different organizations, because we, you know, we want composers to do PR, even if they don't hire us or even if it's not the right time. I think there's a lot composers can do on their own and you know, they forget about it, you know, from website to social media to getting their promotional materials ready. And there really is people that want to hear from composers, that want to listen to music. And it's just important as an artist to get your name out there. So and I think, you know, to go back to Ghent, you know, which just celebrated their anniversary, was the 20th, right, Chandler?
I think it was the 30th.
but I mean, you can see how that has been growing and it became such a staple for, you know, composers together with their peers to celebrate film music. And I can see that I go a lot to Cannes Film Festival, to Berlinale, Sundance, definitely. You know, film music is seen differently now than it was a decade ago. And hopefully that's changing more. My goal is to have a Film Independent Spirit Award for best score. That would be nice. It would be great if Sundance would have an award for, you know, a Sundance score every year. You know, we want to raise the awareness, not only for our clients, but for film music in general.
Okay. Well, let's get into some fun questions, round this hour out. I think that you guys do a tremendous job hyping talent in the industry, but why don't we hype yourselves? Let's play a little theoretical game. Who would play you in a movie about your lives?
Well, I think it's Jake Gyllenhaal for me because I get mistaken as Jake Gyllenhaal twice in my life. So obviously I think he would play me in my movie.
Okay.
Gary Oldman would play me.
That's exactly what I was thinking. So I was thinking more Paul Walker for Chandler, but I realize that's a complete impossibility, but
it's not going to happen. Sorry.
At least Gary's done everything under the sun and had every hairstyle. So maybe there's a chance there. Have you had any geek out moments? I imagine being this close to celebrities or people that you admire and work with. Do you still get chills? Do you still, who geeks you out the most?
Well, I remember being at, and it's funny how Cinderella seems to be a central theme for me, but I was at the LA premiere for Cinderella and I was very excited because I got to meet Grumpy Cat.
Really?
Yes. I was like, move aside celebrities, Grumpy Cat. Just to answer your question overall, do I still get goosebumps? Maybe a little bit for specific people, but after doing this for 10 plus years, you get a little bit accustomed to being around really iconic people. But every now and then, like Grumpy Cat, or I was at the premiere for Hidden Figures, and I got to meet a bunch of astronauts, and I was so excited to meet people who had been to the moon. And like, I met the guy who worked at NASA and he gave me an invitation and a special pin that said I can go to JPL anytime. And so like, that was like super exciting to me. I was like, okay, there's actors here. That's amazing. But these are like people that have been to space.
Excellent, excellent.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just thinking I mean, you know, there were moments, and I remember when I was at the Critics' Choice Awards for Lion, and you know how the setup is, and you know, every film has a table there. And for some reason, they got a cancellation last minute, and the Weinstein Company back then asked me last minute, we need a space filler. Do you want to sit at the table with us? And I was like right in front, and I'm sitting on a table with like Nicole Kidman and Harvey Weinstein, the composers. There's Kate Beckinsale next to me and Tom Ford. And then people come up to me, and because they saw me chatting with Tom Ford, so, and I know the costumer, and she comes from backstage during commercial break, is like, can you introduce me to Tom Ford? So I go over to Tom Ford. I just met this guy, and I introduce them. And then the next person comes, can you introduce me to Tom Ford? And, you know, and then I start talking to Kate Beckinsale, who I knew, my next door neighbor, is a personal trainer. She trained her. So that, you know, at the end, you know, we talked about food, we talked about personal training and all that. And also during Lion, Nicole Kidman, the nicest person in the world, we, Chandler and I, happened to go to New Orleans for a weekend. And yeah, we just told her that we're going to New Orleans. She says, oh my God, here is a list of restaurants. And she gave us her three favorite fish restaurants, all totally low-key, down to earth. And then she remembered the next week we came back, and she's like, so how was New Orleans? How were the restaurants? Did you go? And I'm like, yeah, and here's a restaurant for you. And she's like, well, don't I know my restaurants? Aren't they great? You know, it's at the end, you know, growing up in Austria, seeing the Academy Awards, you feel like, oh my God, it's all, but at the end, it's connections. It's everyone is just a human being, and you have to connect on that level. And everything else, you know, every interview, every panel, every red carpet is really hard work. And so you need that relief also where you talk to someone on a personal level.
Gotcha. Well, on that note, let's connect to your younger selves. Is there an album, a soundtrack, a musician that if you can go back 20, 30 years and give your younger self something to expand their mind and say, you need to watch out for this person. They're gonna blow your mind.
That's such a good question. I don't know.
Well, it's funny because I'm feeling we knew people. Like, I know Falco because before he was Falco, we met Sia before Sia blew up. You met Lady Gaga before she, you know, exploded. So, you know, we've seen that. And I'm like, wow, this is awesome. And would have never known that this is like what's going to happen like a year later, 2 years later. And I think it's also, you know, being in this industry and going to clubs and, you know, getting those invites. We see a lot of people that would just open or do like a charitable concert, and then a year later they are like, you cannot even get close anymore because they're just blowing up.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm speechless when it comes to an album that I would give my younger self, just be like, hey, listen to this album. Probably, what's the Al Green album where Ain't No Sunshine is from? I can't remember the name of that. But that album, I remember blowing my mind when I was little too.
Okay. That, very good answers. Very good answers. It's a loaded question. I don't have one to give myself because I feel like I would struggle to go through that. But I mean, I think we brought up some really good people like, you know, Joseph Trapanese. I mean, Oblivion and Tron Legacy, he was the orchestrator for that. There's some great Daniel Pemberton music that I'm drawn to. Life of Pi is phenomenal, as is Stranger Things. I think the things that I think we're talking about are things that are kind of already in our DNA, whether it's a professional aspect or just a consumer aspect. I think any of those would work. So, and that's a great thing about music. You know, you turn a corner and you'll find some more Indian music you like, or some three note drums from Morocco. So, guys, it's been an absolute pleasure. Please, you know, you can both probably say this at the same time, but give the listeners the website, Twitter handle. How can we find you? How can we find White Bear? Let's hype you guys up.
Sure. Yeah. So our social media handles is at White Bear PR. That's white like the color, bear like the animal, PR like public relations. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter like that, and on Facebook. Search White Bear PR, but we are Facebook.com/thewbpr, and our website www.whitebearpr.com.
And I know, because Mark wants to ask us, what does White Bear have to do with music? And so here Chandler will tell you why we called White Bear PR White Bear PR.
Sure. So I grew up on White Bear Lake in Minnesota. And when we were coming up with company names, it was on the list amongst many other different names. And we sent a list of 10 names around to just various sources. And they all came back with White Bear PR as their number one choice of what they were attracted to. So, you know, the lake I grew up on became the name of the company.
Your mom loved it.
And we're attracted to the work you do. So from the bottom of my heart, guys, speaking for music fans and film score aficionados out there, this has been a tremendous conversation. Look forward to speaking with you and working with you again. So enjoy your weekend, guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Mark. Cheers.